Welcome to Hyde Park. A very warm welcome to you all, dear brothers and sisters and visitors, boys and girls. Thank you for coming to Hyde Park this morning. My name's James Bargeboss. I'll be your chairman this morning, and serving with me is Brother Kieran Wilson. So the theme for Kieran's exhortation this morning, rather appropriately, is looking ahead. And he's asked that we read from Luke chapter 12, from verses 13 to 48.
Thanks for your comments, Barge. Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here. Those who have been here near, those who have travelled far, those who are listening in online as well, good morning, and a happy New Year's Eve to everyone. This time, if we went out and we spoke to someone on the street today and we asked them what today is, they're going to say, well, it's New Year's Eve. It's a time maybe for them to party. It's a time to reflect. It's a time to look back on the past year and see where it's taken you. For some, it might be reflecting on the success that they've had, while others may have had a more challenging year. But with that reflection, regardless of how we ourselves might view 2023, we have a clean slate ahead of us. 2024, it's a fresh year, full of possibilities and hope, full of goals that we're going to set tonight and then forget to do a week later. If it's me anyway. And that's something that I thought that I wanted to consider today, that when we're looking ahead, what are we looking ahead for? Are we looking ahead for ourselves, or are we looking ahead for something longer? So to give a bit of context for what this chapter is about, and I am aware that this was spoken about on Friday night, so please forgive me for that. But basically, this whole section here, before and after as well, is sort of one big discussion that Jesus had with those that were around him. And you can see here that the thoughts and the themes that he presents are all connected. They all flow on. And you can see clearly that thought process that he seems to have. So if we look at verse 1, we can see that there's many thousands of people. And I don't know if you're anything like me, but when I read, sometimes I read that and I can read many thousands of people and I go, cool, let's keep reading. But just try and picture many thousands of people just surrounding this one individual, one person that they're all striving to just see, to catch a glimpse of, to hear what he's saying. The only times I can think of where I've been surrounded by thousands of people is at a sporting event. And in that time, I can barely hear what someone next to me is talking or saying, let alone someone 10 or 20 metres away. And yet here these people were, they were all gathered around, cramming forwards, straining forwards. And in that absolute chaos of the crowd, Jesus would have held their attention in the palm of his hand. So with that sort of just going on in our mind, and we can get just the sheer number of what Jesus is speaking about here, let's pick up what he starts saying in verse 13. We have someone call out from the crowd and he wants to get Jesus' view on inheritance. We don't know anything more about the man. We don't know if he was a firstborn, secondborn, lastborn. That doesn't really matter though. It's what his motivation was. He could have been in the right. He could have been wanting to seek what was fairly his inheritance. But his motivation, something that Jesus would have immediately seen, was that he wanted perhaps more than what he was entitled for. And if he didn't, then he was looking at it from a wrong angle. For he says, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. The NLT translates this as, life is not measured by how much you own. And another translation says, a person's life doesn't consist of the amount of possessions he has. Doesn't matter how many possessions we have, doesn't matter what our bank balance looks like or where we might holiday in the summer. After all, it's not really ours anyway. The earth is the Lord's and all that it contains, the world and all those that dwell in it. And while God might not care about the latest car or the boat, it's still his. And I think that's what Jesus is trying to get at with this parable. If we just look at the parable here that he tells us, and it starts off in verse 16. And he said to them a parable. He said, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What should I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" So what can we see here? Well, the first thing that I see here is that he produced plentifully and he was a rich man. We don't see Jesus condemn this man for being rich. We don't see him saying, "No, this rich man, he should have given money to the poor. He should have donated." No, he just carries on. And you could maybe look at it and say, well, God's blessing this man. God's giving him more and more. The idea of this parable, I don't think, is to say that there's anything wrong with having money. There's plenty of examples throughout Scripture of faithful and extremely wealthy people. And even that wealth isn't required to be donated upon. If we look at Acts chapter 5 with Ananias and Sapphira, they didn't have to sell their lands and give that all up. They were under no obligation to donate it. What they did with it was up to them, and their actions was what led to their downfall. So I just wanted to try and make that a little bit clear. Obviously, wealth is going to be an impact to us if we're striving after it, but it in itself isn't bad necessarily. The second one is we can see this self-reliance creep in, and this is what happens if we do rely on our riches. We can see here, we can see what the man is saying to himself, and I'm going to try and emphasize it as best as I can. "I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods." So you can see there, it's not this idea of, well, this is God's. It's this idea of, well, it's all mine. I've acquired it. I've grown it. There's no thought of God here. There's no thankfulness for all that he has. James, in James chapter 4, has a rather pointed comment on this idea. James says there, "Come now, you who say, 'Today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet what do you know what tomorrow will bring? What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that.'" So again, James isn't saying that we shouldn't conduct business. He's not saying that making profits is bad. But rather, he's saying that we need to have the right focus. We need to give thanks to God, and we need to give that glory back to God as well. And then the last little part here is we can see what God's response is. And I can see almost a mirroring of what the man's language is when it says that the things that he'd prepared. And again, your minds are drawn back to James chapter 4. What is our life? We don't know what tomorrow brings. We may have a plan, but we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And if we extend that out further, we have no idea what's going to be happening in a week, in a month, in 2 months. And as we go on further and further, our idea of what's happening is going to get foggier and foggier. And then almost without pausing for effect, he jumps into this idea of not being anxious. Now, I can tell you one thing. This section is definitely easier said than done. It's very easy to read through this section and go, cool. It's a lot more difficult to sort of put it into action. And this is a section where I've sort of maybe cherry-picked from a little bit. And I've focused just on this section rather than looking elsewhere. It's easier for us to say that we should just let go of it all and let God take over. To not worry about food, clothing or shelter. And especially now in a country that has the cost of living and a housing crisis that impact countless millions of people in this country alone. But while we know that Jesus was speaking these words to those people living in Judea, 2,000 years ago, this message is still for us today. And context as well is important. Like I said, often we might take this little section and we might take it out of context, isolating it from what was spoken before and after. Again, I've already mentioned that there doesn't seem to be a pause there because he starts it off saying, therefore. It's like he's jumping straight in before anyone else can ask a question, add their own little comment. Jesus goes through. So all of what he said before, he's going to summarize for us here and what it really means for us. So it's not like that we should have no care in the world or to not worry and be happy, as Bobby McFerrin would sing to us so eloquently. But rather, Jesus is telling us that we need to rely on God, that we need to rely on his power and on his grace. And yes, the parable is a made-up story that Jesus came up with. But you can see verse 23 and verse 24 almost reads into this a little bit. He says, therefore, life is more than food and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, they do not sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse or barn, and yet God feeds them. How much more valuable are you than birds? Think of the Lord's Prayer as well. Give us this day our daily bread. While we might today have the luxury and the convenience of maybe quickly ducking to the shops and grabbing some milk or bread if we've forgotten, in Jesus' time, bread wasn't a guarantee. You woke up and you weren't 100% sure, am I going to have something to eat? If we jump down to verse 27, we can see this beauty and the majesty of a lily, just a simple lily, far outweighs that of King Solomon. This was a man who in 1 Kings 10 literally took the breath of the Queen of Sheba away when she saw his wisdom, his house, the food, the seating, the clothing of his servants and of the cupbearers. He literally took her breath away. Later on, we can see that King Solomon in 1 year accumulated 666 talents of gold, which is an interesting number, besides that which came from explorers, from business merchants, from kings of the west, from governors of the land. All of his cups were gold. And the writer there stresses that silver was considered as nothing in that day. And yet, despite all of this grand wealth this man had, the simple lily was far better. And while we're on lilies, let's look at that comparison as well, and that of the raven. I mentioned it before, the raven doesn't sow or reap. It scavenges, it takes what it can get and gets out of there. That's what it might look like, but really, God's providing for that raven. Aren't we of more value than a bird? Or the lily? They don't coil or spin. They don't have anything to do with how they look. And yet, as we've seen, God views this lily as being more splendid than Solomon in his prime. So if he's going to clothe the flowers, if he's going to clothe the grass of the field, which was used just as fuel or even as food for the livestock, how much more is he going to clothe us as well? We're of far more importance and worth to God than a simple flower. Again, Jesus makes us stop and consider, which one of us can add a single hour to our life? No matter what, a deadline is a deadline. So if I use a work or a school example, if you have a project due at, say, 5 p.m. on a Monday, you only have until 5 p.m. on a Monday to submit. And it doesn't matter how much you stress about it, that number is always going to reduce. There's always going to be 24 hours, 23 hours. You can't stop time. It will continue to come through. We can't rewind. We can't control it. We might think we do. Maybe we might wake up really early in the morning to go for a run, which is crazy. Or maybe we might work late. We might try and trick ourselves to think that we've made more time for ourselves. But no, we only have 24 hours in a day, no more and no less. But God works differently with this, doesn't he? So I want to look at two different places here just to sort of bring this into an idea. The first place I want to look at is Joshua chapter 10. And this is going to take sort of a literal viewpoint of what's going here, that we can't control time, we can't control anything, but God can. And it's going to show to us just the sheer power that God has. It's Joshua chapter 10, and we're going to read from verse 12 to 14. It says there, at that time Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, sun, stand still at Gibeon, and moon at the valley of Aijon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. And then if we jump down a little bit further, it says, there has been no day like it before or since. So let's just break that down quickly. So we can see here that the sun literally stood still, and it stayed there until Israel was victorious. And some people, I was reading a couple of commentaries on this, some people have tried to explain this phenomenon and tried to reason and find some way to explain why this happened. But really, it's just a miracle of God. It's God showing his immense power that he has. God heeded the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Realistically speaking as well, it was important too. It's not that God gave the Amorites over to Israel to beat. He wanted them to be destroyed. So fighting in the dark isn't really ideal. And we can see that there's never been a day like this before. Again, it's showing us that the might and the power of God, only he can do it. And he's going to pick when and if he does it. And the second point that I want to bring out from this little area is if we glance up a bit and look at the whole chapter, we can see that there's five kings that come together. They decide to attack Gibeon, who had allied themselves with Israel. They cried out for help, so Israel helped. They marched through the night to sneak up on them. The Lord caused them to panic, much like he did with the Midianites, and the Lord caused them to flee. If we look at verse 11, and as they fled before Israel, while they were going down the ascent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw down large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. And this is the real clincher here for me. There were more who died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword. More died from God's actions than from man's actions. Isn't that what Jesus is talking about in Luke 12? That we're not to lean on our own skill, we're not to lean on our own power. This isn't the first time that God's done this either. Think back to the plagues of Egypt. God did all of that. God showed his supreme power and was demonstrating to Israel as well that they needed to trust in him and that they were powerless without him. If God hadn't intervened, Israel would have still been in Egypt. The second verse that I want to look at as well before we jump back is in 2 Peter 3. We're going to pick up a couple of ideas from 2 Peter 3. If we look, we're going to look specifically at verse 8 to 9. Peter says there, "But do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance." So again, first we see here that God isn't bound by time. I can't sort of go any more into it because my brain is probably going to overheat and from thinking about this, but time just works differently for God. Which again, Jesus is telling us, we can't add a single hour to our life. But I also wanted to add that other little section because I can see Jesus' thoughts that he had about the anxiety here as well. We all long for Christ's return. It would have been the number one New Year's Eve present to receive, I think, for an angel to walk through those doors and to whisk us away, that we don't even have to worry about what 2024 has to offer. We might strive not to add time to our lives, but strive to make time go quicker, for Christ to hurry up and return. And yet Peter's telling us that really, God just wants every last person to be saved. It's not on our own time. If it was, it might have already happened. It's on God's time. And he's wanting to call more and more people to him. So no, Joshua and Peter are giving us examples here that we can't add time to our lives. We can't speed up time. And so we ought not to be anxious about it. It's out of our control. It's out of our hands. What we need to do is we need to pray to God and we need to give him the thanks and give him the reliance. So if we come back to Luke 12, we're going to pick it up and we're going to continue looking through from verse 30. Jesus says there, "For all the nations of the world seek after these things." They seek after food, clothing, shelter. "And your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you." These are powerful words. We can see, as I said, a direct competition with the world. "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." So if our heart truly is on the things of God, then it doesn't matter what earthly possessions we may or may not have, or what predicament we may or may not be in. Where our heart is, that's where our treasure's going to be. So in thinking that, you can come across if you want, but you don't have to. It's in Acts chapter 16. We're going to look at Paul and Silas when they are in Philippi. Paul and Silas, they were beaten with rods. They had many blows inflicted of them. And I'm not talking about little taps here. I'm talking about the people really laying into them, giving it everything that they've got. They would have been bruised and battered. There would have been cuts everywhere, probably a concussion, maybe some fractured bones. And then they're thrown into prison. Not just any area, though. It specifies that they were thrown into the inner prison. Now, I got a bit curious and I did a little bit of research. And it's not necessarily saying that this is where they were thrown in, but typically a Roman prison had a couple of different sections. So the first level is pretty light and breezy. It's where you go where you might be waiting to be released, or if you've done something minor but still requiring some punishment. You'd have some fresh air coming through, might be able to see the sunlight. The second level is where you're shut off. You're behind some iron bars and some locks. Some pretty serious stuff. But the third level is the deepest, darkest part of the prison. It's smelly, it's wet, truly an awful place to be. This is where they were thrown, just like they were terrible, terrible criminals. And not only that, stocks around their ankles too, just to add to it. And yet, what was their response? Did they cry out for help? Did they say that they were unfairly beaten, that they didn't receive a fair trial? Did they resent or curse God for failing to protect them, or seek revenge or vengeance against those who did this to them? No, they didn't. Their heart was on God, and that's where their treasure was. So what do? They sang. They prayed. It wouldn't have mattered to them what happened next, because their hearts were on God, and that's where their treasure was. We know the rest of the story. There's the earthquake, and the jailer and his entire house ends up baptized and saved. All because these two men who were beaten decided that they were going to have their hearts set with God. So if we come back to Luke chapter 12, we'll go through just a couple more verses here. And we're going to look at verse 35, because I think Jesus here is really trying to drive home a message. Verse 35 tells us that we need to be ready and waiting for his return. Your version might have that you need to let your loins stay, or to be girded. In other words, back in those days anyway, your robe was going to be tucked into your belt so you can run without any hesitation. We can see here the opposite thinking of the rich fool that was introduced to us in verse 16. That man should have kept his guard up against covetousness. He should have kept his trust in God. And when his life was required, he wasn't dressed or ready for action. He didn't have his running shoes on ready to go. We need to do the opposite. We need to be ready to heed this warning, and we need to be prepared. The language used here is fairly similar to that of the parable of the ten virgins as well. You have lamps that need to remain burning. You have a wedding feast. Only here the master's at the feast and we're waiting for him to return. But the same thoughts still apply here. We need to be on our guard. We need to be watching, and we need to be waiting. Because as with the bridegroom and the master, we don't know when they're going to return. They haven't messaged ahead. They haven't sent a text or given us an ETA. But we must be ready and waiting for them regardless. It could be the second watch or the third watch. In other words, it could be anywhere in the middle of the night. Now, for some, that might be a normal time to return home from a wedding, but at least for me now, if I'm not in bed by 10, maybe 11 at the latest, I'm absolutely gone. So the thought of me figuratively staying up until 4 a.m. sounds exhausting. But if he isn't drilling home this thought enough, he gives us just this one more analogy of the thief breaking in. Just imagine for a moment that you get a text just from a random number and it says, at 2:13 a.m. tonight, I'm going to break in and rob you. What are you going to do? You're going to shrug your shoulders and go, okay, cool. And go to sleep when you usually go to sleep and then get rudely awoken by some smashes and crashes and think, what on earth is going on? Or are you going to stay up? In my case, maybe inform the police so I don't have to do any of the fighting, but you would stay up. You'd be watching. You'd be waiting. Well, unfortunately, that's not going to happen. We're not going to get pre-warned from a robber coming through to break in. And we're not going to get pre-warned that Jesus is about to return. There's going to be signs, sure, but we don't know the exact time when he's going to be happening. So we need to be ready and we need to be waiting to spring into action, even if it is 2:13 a.m. And then Jesus pieces this all together and he gives us this parable, this final piece of advice that we'll look at today. And really, it's not saying anything that he hasn't already outlined. What's special about it, though, is how often he's mentioned his theme. He really wants us to sit up and he wants us to take notice. He says there in verse 43, blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Or doing what things? What's looking over the household, managing the estate correctly, as if the master himself was doing it. They're wise and they're faithful. The exact kind of words we'd want to hear when we see Jesus face to face as well. So that's what we ought to be doing. But Jesus says, if that servant says to himself, my master is delayed in coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants, and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him to pieces and put him with the unfaithful. Again, if we throw our minds back to 2 Peter 3, Peter's warning there was that in the last days, people would mock Christ's return, saying that it won't happen because, hey, it hasn't happened for 2,000 years. They're going to reject his teachings, say that God hasn't or will ever intervene, and maybe even reject the idea of God himself. Now, while these might be people that are speaking from the outside, it could be very well fellow Christians, people weary of the walk, or as Peter puts it, following their own sinful desires. And it's the same here with Jesus' parable. If we get complacent, or if we think, he's been away for a long time, one more day will be fine, then that's when he's going to return. But he says this not to scare us, not to intimidate us, because we know that he and God loves us. Verse 32 makes that incredibly clear to us. It's our Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. They want a kingdom filled with people who love him and who want to be with him. And in case we needed any more evidence that God and that Jesus want you, yes, you, sitting right there, then look no further than the emblems that are before us. There is no greater love than this, that a person would lay down his life for the sake of his friends. And that's exactly what Christ did for us. He sacrificed himself for us, not for worldly gain, not for his own ambitions. He could have easily followed those. But he sacrificed himself for us. Christ's broken body and his spilled blood is before us, showing his love for us. So as we prepare to take these symbols of love in a few minutes, let's remember that we must always be reliant on God, for everything comes from him anyway. And as we count down the end of 1 year and the beginning of the next, let's think about what we're really, truly looking forward to in the coming year. The return of our Lord and Saviour, coming with power and authority to save the world and to save us.